This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
Live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, going live tonight from the Washington, D.C. area. I flew in for the big event tomorrow, Saturday. That is the Justice or Else March. This is a commemoration of the original Million Man March called by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And this time, the theme Justice or Else is being used. Well, I think Justice or Else is pretty much where we need to take the whole truth movement. We've had a truth movement for quite some time, and we already got truth. Anybody who wants to know the truth can pretty well figure it out. But we don't have much justice. So I think this is a very timely theme, and I intend to be out there with a very large number of people on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, demanding justice or else. There will be 9/11 Truth speakers that will be represented from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and that is one of the themes, one of the places where we desperately need to get some justice. So if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, please come on down to the National Mall tomorrow and participate in this historic Justice or Else event. All right, well, let's do the quick plug for Revolution Radio, the best listener-supported station, or network, rather, in existence in the entire known universe. Please do go to freedomslips.com and give generously to keep this kind of programming alive. Let's move on to the topic of tonight's show, and that is we've got a special two-hour edition of Truth Jihad Radio coming up with Stephen Requa. Stephen Requa is an incredibly interesting guy. He's the author of a number of books, including The Great Gold Grab. He comes from a background of, a family background of gold miners in the gold industry, and that led him to encounters with, what do we call it, the organized crime industry? That's pretty much what it is. It's pretty amazing where he's gone with this. Stephen Requa has picked up the gauntlet and gone after the criminal deep state that rules the country. And so we're going to see if we can get him on the call here. Let's give it a shot. Here we go. I'm working on my friend's computer tonight, so it's all a little bit edgy, as it always is when we go live here on Revolution Radio. But I think we may have connected here with Stephen Requa. Stephen, is that you? No, maybe we don't have him up yet. Okay, we're bringing him up. It's taking a little time here. I'm broadcasting from the general neighborhood of the National Security Agency in Maryland. So proximity there may make their job easier than usual. I don't know. Anyway, I think we got Stephen. Are you there?
Yep.
Hey, welcome, Stephen. How are you?
Very good, thank you. It's very nice receiving your invitation.
Well, I appreciate your coming on. It looks like you've been doing some really interesting work. I got some communiques from friends, including Professor Anthony Hall from the University of Lethbridge, who's been investigating Barrick Gold and the connections of the Bush family and a whole bunch of usual suspects with that outfit. And it seems that the gold business is very much, tied in with these issues of the deep state, the criminal deep state that we keep trying to expose on shows like this. And we're hoping that we're going to finally get some justice someday going after these people. I'm here in D.C. for the Justice or Else event tomorrow on the Mall. We're going to be maybe up to 1 million people. Who knows? A lot of people demanding justice or else. So you've been working on this stuff for quite some time. Maybe you could tell folks how you went from your background in family with gold industry expertise into your current activities exposing the deep state.
I was just a necessity to look into that because there I was in 1993 with some very good mining funds in Nevada with respective $1 billion gold deposits.
Stephen, could you maybe speak a little closer to the mic because it seems a little faint, at least here on my end. Okay.
Any better?
Yeah, that sounds better.
Okay. So, in 1993, I was proceeding to develop some gold properties in Nevada that were prospective for $1 billion gold deposit. And suddenly, overnight, without notice, my whole company was put into a receivership. And my bank accounts were seized, and there were some files were seized. And the files included what my family had gathered over 100 years of gold exploration in the U.S. And South America and Central America. And I could imagine how that could happen. I had $400,000 in my checking account and no debt. And suddenly I found myself declared into a receivership. So I had to figure out how that could happen. And then I had to find out what happened to the files, because they contained all the information that my father and grandfather and Herbert Hoover and his sons had developed over 50 years in locating where new gold deposits could be developed. And so it was very valuable data that we obviously wanted. But I couldn't figure out at the time how anything like that could happen. You know, we're supposed to live in a constitutional state. We did. I thought we did. And now we can see that we don't. But
And did they file, like, criminal charges or anything, or was it one of these situations where they just seize your stuff for no particular reason? Because that does happen.
Well, they filed an application for appointing a receiver, which was acted upon overnight without any notice being given.
Wow.
And I can get in a little bit later to how they managed to do that. But that's what I've been trying to figure out ever since. And then I wrote my first book, The Great American Gold Grab, during the 1990s, and up to when it was published in 2009. And that book is basically a 650-page affidavit. It was everything I could possibly remember to try to make some sense, or someday to make some sense of how it could happen. And I eventually found out, speaking of the role of gold in the deep state and so on, that the Requa Hoover files were first in the minds of the founders and directors of the Federal Reserve Bank to create them in 1917, when they brought my grandfather, Mark L. Requa, and Herbert Hoover, President to me, together, and they were the leading mining engineers in the world. And they brought them together in a whole series of meetings that someone, a mining historian, dug up, and I have a list of those meetings, and they were dominated mostly by Federal Reserve directors and founders in 1917. And the result with Woodrow Wilson, you know, people like Bernard Baruch and so on. And what resulted from those meetings was my grandfather, Mark Requa, was appointed as oil director for the country for World War I, meaning that he could allocate oil to anyone he decided to. He could abrogate the contract and just order the oil to go wherever he and the oil division the fuel administration decided it needed to go.
Well, that war provided a great excuse for centralizing power for things like that, didn't it?
What's that?
World War I provided an excuse for that sort of thing.
Well, essentially, the oil industry was almost nationalized. And so then after the war, that had established his relationship with Herbert Hoover. I'm not sure why Herbert Hoover went to all those meetings together. But anyway, he did. But they had it obviously in mind after the war and so on that Mark Requa and Herbert Hoover would collaborate in creating the Requa Hoover files and locating where gold deposits would be. And the only reason that they would have done that is that they had an agenda to acquire gold deposits. And I figured out the reason that they had that agenda is because they were in the process of making the dollar progressively worthless. And since 1917, the dollar has lost 95% of its value. So it would be, understandable that all these Federal Reserve bankers would want to get gold.
Mm-hmm.
So they went after Hoover left the White House. They went all over the Americas, up to Alaska, down Central America, South America, looking for gold deposits. And in fact, the first one that they developed almost, well, they did bring it to production in Mercury, Utah, was the Mercury gold mine, and then they developed metallurgical problems after spending $1 million in the 1930s, and couldn't mine it. But then in 1973, Getty Oil had solved the metallurgical problems and wanted to develop it. So they got all my father's records on the Mercury gold mine. And that allowed Barrick Gold, actually, to go public in 1983. That was Barrick Gold went public on Ben Ardell.
Wow. They're basically trying to monopolize this.
Oh, yeah. The whole thing was obviously trying to monopolize the gold to the extent it could after they had made their money worthless.
Right. That's a pretty... pretty big time scam, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah, they give us the funny money and they keep the gold.
Yeah, exactly. It started in 1917. That's what was their agenda, starting in 1970, to create the Hoover Files by bringing Requa and Hoover together for the first time.
Wow. So, you know, a lot of people talk about how the gold markets are rigged. The price of gold is kept artificially low, and that someday that's going to blow up.
I think so. I'll send you some information on that. I don't really pay much attention to all these manipulations and so on. They're all going to evaporate anyway. But at the end of the day, there's a supply and demand curve, and gold will assert its value sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you think that might be sooner rather than later now that the petrodollar is looking shaky and geopolitically we see Russia kind of standing up to the U.S. in Syria as well as in Ukraine.
Well, that's very possible. I tend not to look too much at all these political things, although I did get quite interested in following veterans' news after the Syria thing developed. And I remember the first big article that impressed me was Gordon Duff's the Free Fall of the American Dictatorship. Remember seeing that?
Yeah, I kind of vaguely remember that. I read as much of Gordon's stuff as I can. You know, I'm an editor over there at Veterans Today.
Right. Well, it was about the big fraud, the Bush election one in 2000.
And right, right.
How all these crimes were committed in this. That generals and all sorts of people were saying that this whole house of cards that was created in that election is going to collapse. But when it all collapses, I don't know, but I do know that the best thing to do, in any case, is to acquire gold. Because that's, in the end, the golden rule is to use the gold rule.
Well, I've heard from people like Matthias Cheng, who's a former economic advisor to the ex-prime minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, that he thinks that we're going to see a complete adjustment of world currency. It's going to be the end of the petrodollar as a de facto world reserve currency, and what replaces it will have to be pegged to gold.
Yeah, well, I think so, or it might even get worse than that, but it might be who physically has the gold in the stock where we didn't get it. But my focus as a geologist has been to look for bonanza type gold deposits, in other words, very high grade gold deposits. You'd probably be surprised to find out that the 580 recognized gold deposits in the world, the average gold content of those deposits is only 1 gram per ton, which is 0.03 ounces per ton, less than 0.03 ounces per ton. So it takes a lot of time just to make 1 ounce of gold. Whereas in a bonanza fat gold deposit, like the Comstock Lode, like these famous ones in during the age of the conquistadors, were producing gold with producing deposits with gold into the multiple ounces and many ounces of silver per ton. So if the price of gold went below 1,000, 90% of the world's gold mining companies would be unprofitable.
Well, it sounds like we're reaching peak gold. You know, people talked about peak oil a lot, but it sounds like peak gold is here.
Established that what's going to happen. The production of gold is definitely going to diminish. And the only effect that can have is that the supply diminishes and the price will go up. But they do exert all sorts of mechanisms to manipulate the price of gold.
And you wonder, how can they do that? I mean, how can you ever beat the law of supply and demand for that long?
Well, I'll send you a good link that'll explain some of that. I don't get into it enough to be able to explain it very well to others because they just buy and sell contracts for gold. Where there isn't really any gold, it's just a contract. I lose my patience when I follow all these financial manipulation schemes, and I just try to focus on where we're going to find some big gold deposits. And I finally succeeded in cracking a big mystery out of Nevada where a famous long-sought mother lode has been found to be. We just pretty much finalized figuring out the gold system. And there will be somewhere between 5 and 10 million ounces of gold, in high grade gold. So that's what I'm especially focusing on right now. But as a result of all these things that happened to me, I had to ask myself, well, how could all these things happen? So I ended up finding out things like the Federal Reserve founders and directors basically having an agenda to create the recovery of power. And then I found out that in 1973, after Getty Oil had acquired the data for the Plum property, which they then took public with Barrett, they wanted all the rest of the files. You know, they had thousands of files that the Rickoff and the Hoovers and all their associated people had spent probably $100 million in gathering all the data. It was mind-blowing data. And they came into my father's office one day, the Getty geologist, and after they saw what was in the first files that my father did a deal with them on at Merford, they wanted access to all the rest. And so I was there. I'm sure my father said no, they were for us, because any one of those files could produce a miner, which would yield, the billions of dollars. So they left, and then I went back to California, and I was staying in an apartment in San Francisco. And then I was just on the spur of the moment, one weekend, I decided to drive down the peninsula to Pescadero. And then when I came back on the next Monday, the manager of the apartment house said, "Did you hear what happened to Mr. Edelman?" He was man of the big apartment building. And I said, "No, he was murdered." So as I pieced it together and the things I've written lately, is that it was intended for me to be framed. That John Paul Getty wanted the files, and his way of getting it was going to be to frame me into a murder.
But it didn't work out, though.
No, because I left San Francisco just on the spur of the moment, so just when the murder happened. So as soon as it happened, I wasn't anywhere around to be playing.
Man, that's so you're playing with some heavy hitters here.
And the first idea I had of that was I went back. I decided, well, I really don't want to stay in San Francisco. I never knew anyone that had been murdered before, so I decided to go back to Utah and be working with my father. And when I got back, an FBI agent came knocking on our door, and my father let him into my room, and he said, there's an FBI man who wants to see you. And what he said was, he wanted to know why my cell phone number had been found written on the wall of the Symbionese Liberation Army hideout.
Oh, no.
You know, the SLA, you know, like Patty Hearst and all that.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. I'm old enough to remember Patty Hearst.
So, I told him, well, of course, I didn't have any idea how my cell phone number in California could be written on their hideout wall. And I forgot about it. Well, as I figured out years later, when other things happened, it was written on a hideout wall because some FBI agent wrote it there. Or else just put it in the files that had been found there. Because 20 years later, when this whole court fraud episode turned up, I was talking to one FBI agent, and he wanted me to come in and talk to him, and he referred to some interview that supposedly the San Francisco police detective had of me about the Edelman murder. But I had never talked to anyone about it. But the interview said that I had been leading a rent strike against the man that was murdered. So it was obvious that they were trying to build some sort of a way, they had established some way to frame me into that murder. And that then, of course, that I would have been dead somehow, and then they would have been able to jump all day. He would have been able to get all the recovery files from my father.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about the content of those files, and what's so hot about those files?
Oh, well, probably $100 million was spent on finding any evidence of the gold deposits. If you go to the website, there's a link on the homepage about the Rico Hoover files, and you can read all about them. They were established by it cost at least $100 million to generate all that data in Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Idaho, Utah, Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia. Alaska, those are the main states.
Wow. So when you have possession of something like that, knowing the capabilities of some of these bad actors, how can you keep that secure?
Well, at the time that it was court fraud, I had them in two bank vault rooms. In file cabinet stacked up to the ceiling of these two rooms with all sorts of high-tech security. And I was the only one that had the combination to the foot-thick steel doors. But then they did this fraudulent receivership and just stole everything overnight. And then they brought in heavy equipment and knocked down the walls of the bank.
Wow.
To get into the bank vaults and steal all the data.
Man.
And meanwhile, I was being chased all over the place by all kinds of disreputable-looking people, and obviously FBI agents and local police who were trying to plant evidence of murders in my vehicle. I would find it, every once in a while. I would search my vehicles every morning, and I found on several occasions evidence that that looked like murders, which I was like I planted a knife and some buggy tires, and so every morning I would check my vehicle for anything that had been planted. And I found things on it. And then I was arrested on a fake traffic warrant that I'd paid off a long time before. And then the police were very upset when they weren't able to find the things that they had planted in my vehicle.
Now you ended up working with William Pepper, who's been on the show a few times. He's famous for having helped, he ran that civil trial that found that bad people in our government and CIA, FBI, and U.S. Army had killed Dr. Martin Luther King. He's also working on the Bobby Kennedy assassination, defending Sirhan Sirhan. And so you worked with him. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, after going through all these things, I realized that, particularly after this Edelman murder and some people knowing about that, we should not have had any, way of knowing about that. In other words, that either they were seriously trying to frame me, even steal the things in 1993, so I decided that the handwriting was on the wall, and I just better leave the country, which is what I did. And I went to London, and there I saw in the paper one day an article about this case that Pepper had developed, and that the real conspiracy consisted of FBI and H.L. Hunt, the oil billionaire, and Carlos Marcello, the mafia boss of New Orleans. So anyway, he put it all together and it proved it very, very thoroughly that Martin Luther King was killed by a mafia hitman who shot him while he framed up James Earl Ray.
Okay, well, actually, the mafia hitman, I believe, was the best sharpshooter in the Memphis Police Department, wasn't it? And then they had a U.S. Army sniper team on the rooftop in case the first guy missed.
Right. Yeah. That's all the case. And then the real sniper fired from bushes to shoot at the king on the balcony of this hotel. And then the next day, all the bushes that he had been in were just chopped down and taken away.
Right. Yeah. And that was a real scandal. And it involved, some of the same people, this kind of corrupt deep state that's behind so many of these things. And you've exposed a kind of a Nazi connection to this.
What I found out was, in 2001, I got contacted by Dr. Robert Cutler, who had been the dean of the Stanford Medical School, and he'd come across a memorandum in Stanford Archives about me in 1983, having gotten some information in Hawaii about David Starr Jordan, and another man being behind the murder of James Stanford.
Now remind our listeners, what year was this, the James Stanford murder?
1905.
Right, okay.
And so, in looking into all of that, Cutler wrote his book, and then he and I were on the front page of the LA Times about it when it was published, and then he died about a year later, and then I went on to try to finish my book. And in the process, I started having things happen to me in Honduras, similar to when the receivership was done. There was a whole libel campaign against me, all kinds of false allegations against me were spread all over the place. And I started in Honduras, and so I thought, that's too similar to what happened in 1993, and it's somehow related to this murder of James Stanford. So I figured, I had to get into looking up all the uh, emails, the 300 emails that I had gotten from Cutler about trying to crack that. And in doing that, I started looking beyond the scope of his investigation. His investigation was just to prove that she had been murdered by a shipping partner. That's what the Hawaii State inquest ruled. Strict items in her body, and that's how she died. And so that was all covered up, spruced. And somehow the answer to all this libel campaign to me was in those emails that Cutler had sent me. So I started looking into those and following up, and then I found out that who was really behind her murder. And that was U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt, and Governor Whitelaw Reed, who was an executor for Jane Stafford. They lived in New York and hopped on a train to make a beeline to Stanford, 3,000 miles away, so they could arrive just in time for her death to be announced. And then the Whitelaw Reed was there to basically to conduct a probate fraud and convince everybody that she had died of natural causes.
Maybe we should back up for a second and just remind the listeners who may not have remember who Jane Stafford is. She's the heiress to a railway fortune, founder, bequeather of Stanford University, etc.
Yeah, she, Jane Stafford and Leland Stafford had started the university. Their only son, Leland Stafford Jr., had died as a teenager. I can't remember which disease, anybody, he had died. And then sometime after he died, he appeared to Leland Stafford in a dream. And said, make all children your children. Something to indicate that he should build a university in his son's name, which he did. And then he died in 1894, at which time my great grandfather Isaac Requaw became president of the Central Pacific Railroad. And Jane Stafford just carried on with her university. Mm-hmm. So,
And getting to the murder, maybe tell us a little bit about the motive behind that.
Well, as it turned out, John D. Rockefeller really wanted control of Stanford, and Jane Stafford had decided that she was going to dismiss the president of the university, David Starr Jordan, for all sorts of reasons. And that precipitated a crisis for them because basically Rockefeller and Teddy Roosevelt were running the university through him. And if Jane Stafford fired David Starr Jordan, then they would have lost control of the university. So they had to hurry up and get rid of her.
And why was control of the university so important to these people?
Well, for one, they were planning on creating a lot of eugenics organizations based on this creed that they had that the Rockefellers and Harrimans and David Starr Jordan really founded was eugenics. And that one of the big pushes was to enforce or forced sterilization, so unfit people couldn't reproduce. And according to them, unfit people were usually people of color, or poor people, or some other arbitrary characteristics that made them unfit.
Yeah, well, they actually got a court order in Indiana to mass sterilize a group of people called the Ishmaelites, who were supposedly a group of tri-racial isolates. That is, they were supposedly descended from escaped African slaves, Native Americans, and then escaped indentured servants and other backwoods-type free whites who who all mingled in the wilderness, and supposedly they had a little bit of Islam that was brought over from Africa, which is where we get the town, the city names of Medina, Mecca, Illinois, Muhammad, Illinois, and so on. They were migratory. Anyway, those people were the victims of the first ever court order for mass sterilization, which was issued towards the end of the 19th century, and it was the Rockefellers who were pushing that.
Yeah, well, that was their big thing. And they were trying to institute these laws based on eugenics, that things like poverty could be inherited.
Well, if you don't inherit wealth, I guess you inherit poverty.
Well, basically, it was these were Rockefellers were people who their greatest fear was the poor. The poor would get together and displace them, overtake their system.
Yeah, that seems to be a common fear. You know, I actually got to hear that firsthand from the wife of Wisconsin's biggest industrialist, Terry Kohler, who came over for dinner to my parents' house when I was young. They were buying out North Sales, the sail-making business, and Terry Kohler's wife gave us a little monologue about what would happen when those terrible, you know, Democrats and poor people took over, that they would, they would basically eat us alive. You know, she was very afraid of that. Apparently, a lot of wealthy people have this fear that the poor folks are one day going to rise up and devour them.
Yeah, well, they especially had that the end of the 19th century and the first of the 20th century, and that was the big fear of Rockefeller and Harriman and other people. So that's why they were interested in eugenics, is because what they were going to do is they were going to sterilize all the people who they were afraid they were going to rise up against.
Well, that's one way to stop the revolution. Get rid of people.
Yeah, well, that's what they tried. And so I started reading into all this stuff, which was just horrifying. How anyone could have believed in it. And
Hitler ended up giving it a bad name.
Yeah, well, Hitler got all his plans for more sterilization and eugenics from David Starr Jordan.
Yeah.
That, Nazism was really founded by the president of Stanford University.
Right, yeah, they probably don't have a plaque at the university commemorating that fact, do they?
No, but they have lots of plaques commemorating David Starr Jordan, what a great man he was, but he was just horrible. Yeah, so he actually engineered the poisoning of Jane Stanford. Jane Stanford's secretary was his, you know, secret love. And they had an affair going on. And so she was telling David Starr Jordan everything that she knew about Jane Stanford. So one of the things that she told David Starr Jordan was that Jane Stanford was going to fire him. So that would have called all her plans for creating all these eugenics organizations and creating all this legislation for forced sterilization and stuff. So if they were going to carry on with that program, they had to get rid of Jane Stanford right away. So Whitelaw Reid, and who owned the New York Tribune, and his son-in-law, Darius Ogden Mills, hopped a train in New York and sped in 1905 rail cars all the way to California, 3,000 miles, to get there just in time for Jane Stanford to be poisoned in Hawaii. She had gone to Hawaii after they had tried to poison her the first time. And
So how did they poison her?
Well, with strychnine.
Did they eat her food?
Yeah. Well, the first time was in a bottle of mineral water, and she noticed this peculiar bitter taste and decided to, you know, stick her finger down her throat and, you know, throw up. And so then they took the mineral water to some pharmacist chemist to analyze it, and it turned out it was full of strychnine.
You think that would make her a little more careful about what she would ingest?
Well, there she was living in her palatial mansion, and she just had her secretary there and the hospital staff, and so it was a mystery. But her secretary, Bertha Berner was her name, was the only one who was present at both poisonings. So they ended up going to Hawaii, and it was probably my great-grandfather, Isaac Riefenbach, who recommended that they leave. Because, well, he was president of the railroad, 420 locomotives, and so and the families were interrelated. His son, Mark L. Riefenbach, married Josiah Stanford's their sisters, my grandmother's sister, and had married Josiah Stanford while my grandfather married Mark Riefenbach. So they were related by marriage. So anyway, the way I figured it out, and the way the Cutler figured it out, is that the reason that my great grandfather was also poisoned was because that he was the only one who had the money and the clout to have figured out what was going along and who had poisoned James Stanford. But anyway, so she had gone to Hawaii and then got poisoned there by the same woman. And so Cutler and I figured this out, that it had to have been Jordan and Bertha Berner who had poisoned her. And then as soon as she was poisoned, Whitelaw Reed showed up with various Ogden Mills, and then Jordan went to Hawaii to get her body back. And then the day before the Hawaii State Inquest ruled that she had been poisoned with strychnine, Theodore Roosevelt appointed Whitelaw Reed as ambassador to the UK.
Got him out of there fast, huh?
Well, that was the payoff. They had planned on doing that for some time. And it was John D. Rockefeller wanted Whitelaw Reed as ambassador to the UK so he could liaise with the Rothschilds about creating the Federal Reserve Act.
So it's the same group of very, very wealthy criminals that we keep seeing cropping up over and over and over from this James Stanford murder to the Federal Reserve coup d'etat to getting us into World War One to the coup attempts against Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Butler coup and so on. And the poisoning, you speak of poisoning of James Stanford, how about the poisoning of Franklin D. Roosevelt? Same people.
Oh, right, those are... I'm trying to remember who that was.
Well, they suspect it was that there was a Russian artist that was brought in, and she was a white Russian, and they'd been, you know, these wealthy people had been working with a lot of white Russians, who, you know, were very, very right wing, very pro oligarchy. So, you know, the suspicion falls on a painter that was brought into the Roosevelt White House. And there's some evidence that she brought in all these chemicals used in painting, including some poisons. Anyway, that's the story I've heard.
Yeah. Well, apparently Stalin told someone that Roosevelt had been poisoned.
Yeah, I think he told like Roosevelt's son or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So this is our deep state.
Yeah. And it's all connected with these, very rich people at the turn of the century, Rockefeller, Harriman, primarily, who were creating this eugenics to, kill off all the poor people that, if they could. And but it was also to create this eugenics organization as a front. So that they could get donations. In fact, it was $100 million that Rockefeller donated to the Eugenics Record Office, who had been one of the eugenics organizations that had been formed by Baby Star Jordan and Theodore Roosevelt. And gave him $100 million in 1912 and 1913. Well, there was nothing absolutely that a eugenics record office could do with $100 million. And then they were actually ordered to vaccinate. Were determined, in a surprise island, they were determined not to produce anything valuable. So we got $100 million in 1912 and 1913. It was basically used by Theodore Roosevelt number one, for him to launch this third party candidacy, Bull Moose candidacy, so that it would split the Republican vote and put Woodrow Wilson into the White House in the 1912 election.
Good, just in time to preside over the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Yes, exactly. So Taft had vowed to veto it, and Woodrow Wilson passed it. And it had to do with the $100 million that Rockefeller gave them to the Eugenics Record Office. So until the Federal Reserve was established, that's how all these payoffs and bribes were going up in the time of James Stafford's death. It was through these eugenics organizations that were being fronts for donations.
Right. Well, you know, the eugenics movement kind of hit upon bad times when Hitler gave him a bad name. But a lot of people these days think that the eugenicists, especially these extremely wealthy people in the deep state, the so-called New World Order elite, is still interested in eugenics. And there's even a theory, it sounds paranoid, but who knows, that they are perfectly willing to dumb us down and poison us, and that, you know, some of the toxic effects of modern civilization we see around us, such things as chemtrails, aluminum, barium, and strontium supposedly being dumped in the air, and the extremely high levels of electromagnetic radiation, this electromagnetic soup that we live in, that is literally millions of times more potent than levels that have been proven harmful to health. These various kinds of harmful health effects, be it fluoride in the water supply, et cetera, there are folks who believe that all this stuff is intentional. That is, the powers that be, this shadow state, deep state, these wealthy folks, are actually dumbing us down, trying to sterilize us. And there's some evidence that the electromagnetic radiation could lead to mass infertility within a few generations, and that this is essentially eugenics by other means.
Yeah. Well, if you pump all these chemicals into the environment, you're going to decrease the cognitive capacities of people in some ways. So then they don't think about what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that's what a lot of people think about fluoride. You know, they say that Hitler used fluoride in his concentration camps to keep people pacified, supposedly chops off a few points from IQs and makes people less spirited and willing to rise up and assert themselves. It kind of... I used to scoff at such things, but not so much anymore.
Right. What I'd like to do right here is quote a few things. One of the things that I came across is I was looking into all this eugenic stuff and how the Rockefellers were funding the Nazis to do all kinds of things. And it actually creating the Rockefellers and the Harrimans were all their little Wall Street crowd were financing Hitler's creation. They funded Hitler into office, and then they funded him all through through World War II.
Now was this a case of the rich bankers funding both sides, or was there one faction of the elite that was pro-Nazi and another faction that was anti-Nazi?
Well, there was there's this the actual fascist component of the so-called elite, I think, is fairly small, but it's particularly evidenced by the Rockefellers, the Dulleses, the Bushes. But anyway, Anthony Sutton was a researcher at Stanford Tudor Institute, and he looked into all the stuff around the rise of Nazism. And I'll read you a quote from Anthony Sutton. You can look at it. He has great YouTubes on the internet and wrote all kinds of books. But anyway, he had to finally leave Stanford because he was exposing how all these people who were donating to Stanford had created Hitler. But anyway, according to Anthony Sutton, I'll read the quote. According to this information, the Council on Foreign Relations played an important role in funding the Nazis and orchestrated the investigations to prevent their connections from being made public. This is a major historical lie. The evidence also suggests that Wall Street, the Council of Foreign Relations, not only funded, but arguably created the Nazi war machine. Then, at the very core of Nazism, says Professor Sutton, we find Wall Street, including Standard Oil of New Jersey and ITT representatives, up to as late as 1944, referring to Wall Street's role in funding the Nazis as being part of a consolidation plan for world domination, he concludes. This interplay of ideas and cooperation was only one facet of a vast and ambitious system of cooperation and international alliance for world control. The professor quotes an establishment insider, Georgetown professor Dr. Carol Quigley, as saying that Hitler was nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political systems of each country and the economy of the world as a whole.
Well, that pretty well sums it up.
That's fabulous. So, World War II was, it was kind of a charade. World War II was created by these Wall Street bankers who had funded Hitler into power, and they expected he would win. And then when he didn't, Nelson Rockefeller's Standard Oil tankers were fueling Nazi U-boats all during the war. So
that was a pro-Nazi faction of the elite then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They had created it, and they expected he would win, and it was part of a plan. Not all the details of it, someone like Anthony Sutton and Carol Quigley, they evaluated it as that, and that's what it must have been. And then when he didn't win, the critical thing was that when Hitler didn't win, then all these people, the Dulleses and the Bushes and the Harrimans and the Rockefellers, all siphoned off all these Nazi gangsters that Hitler put into power into Latin America and into the U.S.
It was Operation Paperclip.
Yeah. And so Alan Dulles gave the Nazi General Galen, he had an intelligence organization, and he gave him $200 million to operate. And so all these Nazis came into the U.S., and it's all been exposed by, first of all, by Mae Brussel, which anyone can look her up, and there are all kinds of those links. And
John Loftus did some work on this, didn't he?
Oh yeah, he has some great interviews. Absolutely great. He's one of the best commentators about how they Alan Dulles hit all these horrible Nazi war criminals by putting them into the CIA.
Yeah, it seems like it's not just the neoconservatives whose philosophy is if you can't beat the Nazis, join them. It's the whole establishment's philosophy was, well, even if you can beat the Nazis, join them.
Yeah, well, starting off, they created the Nazis to begin with.
right.
if you just look at it, the Rockefellers and the Dulleses were Nazis. They financed Hitler into existence. Build his war machine. And the Council of Foreign Relations did all this. So here you have the Council of Foreign Relations. All the president's cabinet belong to the Council of Foreign Relations, but they're all dedicated to destroying the United States. They're dedicated to creating a fascist state.
And so it's not surprising that a Bush, which is a family that's right in the middle of this thing, would be in the White House when we have our American Reichstag fire on September 11th, 2001.
No, it's not.
Wild. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and it's really pretty amazing that these people still get away with it. You know, our schools, universities, and our media, our historians all preach about the evils of the Nazi war machine, and yet the people that are running our country today actually built it. They never seem to tell us that. Well, we're going to be back for another hour of talk in just a moment. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Stephen Requa, and we have a whole lot more to talk about. He's been in the middle of a lot of amazing stuff, so stick around. Well, welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett talking tonight with Stephen Requa about the Nazi Hydra in America. And that's actually the name of a book by Greg Felton, who's researched some of these same topics. And he's available to come on and join the conversation. So Stephen Requa, have you heard about Greg Felton's work?
Felton or Yaden?
There's Yaden too, yeah. But no, this is Felton. One of his books is called The Nazi Hydra in America. And it goes into some of the same topics we were just talking about. Let me see if we can pull Greg up here. I'm sure he would be really interested in hearing what you have to say.
Sure.
So let's see if I can get Greg on here. Okay. I don't know if he's coming in here or not, but we'll see if this works. Hello, Greg, are you there? Let's see, here we go, we're going to get him. Greg's out in Vancouver, B.C., and he's done a lot of work on the deep state. He's a former mainstream journalist who took the red pill a while back and never looked back. I think we have him now. Is that Greg? Hello, Greg. Well, I don't hear him, so maybe if he gets his microphone working, we will. Stephen, we were talking a little bit about the... Oh, there we go. Is that Greg?
Yeah, that's me here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Very well.
You know, we've got Stephen Requa on the line. Stephen Requa is the author of The Great Gold Grab and a bunch of other books, including some on some of the same topics that you take up in the Nazi Hydra in America. I don't know if you're familiar with Stephen's work and his background. We were talking about that in the first hour. It's fascinating stuff. He comes from a family of mining engineers with relationships with some of the big movers and shakers who basically tried to screw him over and his family over for being independent. It's basically the same kind of Federal Reserve bankster cartel that we all know about. So I was thinking I might kick back and let you two guys have a little bit of a conversation. I think it is you've both done work on the same topic. So we were just talking about the way that this cartel of big-time financiers, the people who are trying to monopolize the gold, bob off the Federal Reserve funny money on everybody else, take over the political system and turn it into an authoritarian oligarchy, whether through outright, Nazism and support of the Nazis and the fascist rise prior to World War II, or through the kind of things that are going on today in our post 9/11 world. And you were talking also about the way that Alan Dulles and his friends brought Nazi scientists, to the U.S. after World War II in Operation Paperclip. And you wrote about that in the Nazi Hydra in America, as I recall. Is that right, Greg? Hello, Greg? Well, we may have lost Greg Felton again. Stephen, are you there?
Yeah, well, I was eager to get a point in here. What really happened after World War II is that they eliminated Nazism and fascism in Germany, but then Dulles and all these other people and the Vatican just disseminated all the worst of the Nazi war criminals all over the world, particularly in South America and in the U.S., where they just carried on creating and seeking to create their fascist system. And this actually brings up something you'll be very interested in. You once wrote this great article about whether the Knights of Malta fired Pope Benedict.
Right. I remember writing that article. I was actually in Tehran at a conference at the time, and we were all amazed when this Pope's resignation, first time in 800 years, happened. And you don't have to scratch very far beneath the surface to see that the kind of typical Vatican corruption was a big factor in this.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, the Knights of Malta, you know, they're one of the two big Vatican intelligence arms, the other one being with the state, the biggest and oldest one being Knights of Malta. If you look at who appoints Knights of Malta, you see that people who get appointed as Knights of Malta come from basically the CIA and from the Rothschilds. And they're the ones who, hire and fire Pope. The Pope doesn't know who he's creating when he appoints all these CIA or even Mafia people as Knights of Malta. And in fact, the Rothschilds, Eustace Mullins revealed, have been controlling the Vatican finances since early in the 19th century.
I'm sure a lot of Catholics would be kind of surprised to hear that. The Rothschilds don't have a reputation as being the world's most devout Catholics.
Well, what happened? What happened was, they had the settlement. Italy had a settlement between Mussolini and the Vatican for, in which they paid the Vatican $39 million, in the 1930s sometime, for, I guess it was land they took from the Vatican. They had, so they just reduced the Vatican building down to Vatican City, and then they got $39 million compensation. So all that $39 million, as Loftus discovered, was then invested in Nazi Germany.
Now, was there a Rothschild connection to the financing of the Nazis? This has been an issue between Gordon Duff and Webster Tarpley. Tarpley has talked about the House of Morgan and the Bush family and so on being involved in financing the rise of Hitler. And Gordon insists that Tarpley is ignoring the elephant in the living room, which is the Rothschilds being behind the House of Morgan. Therefore, the Rothschilds, the founding family of the State of Israel, engineered the rise of Hitler. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive. It's like, wait a minute. If you stop and think about it, actually the State of Israel never could have been created if it weren't for the world wars. First World War I to create the pretext for the Balfour Declaration. And then World War II, because that provided the myth of the evil Nazis that could be used to mobilize global support for the State of Israel. So Stephen, I take it that you'd say that the Rothschilds are right up at the top of the food chain of these global financiers, oligarchs, and deep state criminals.
Well, all I know is just really what the Eustace Mullins said, that the Rothschilds were in charge of Vatican finances from the early 1800s, and then the Vatican did invest, as Loftus figured out, all about $39 million in the 1930s that they got from Mussolini into Nazi Germany. So that's all I've been able to to ascertain and as far as that aspect goes.
Yeah, it's, you know, and then there's the angle of the drug money laundering through the Vatican, and that's been I think it was at Paul Williams who discusses this in his book on Operation Gladio, that the CIA made a decision to follow the model of Chiang Kai-shek, who'd had a lot of success financing his operations with drug money, and so post World War II, right after World War II, they made that decision, and they needed places to launder that money, and the Vatican Bank was the world's biggest secret bank, and so the Vatican Bank became the CIA's biggest drug money laundry.
Yeah, yeah, and also the mafia, the big monsters in the U.S. have stated that more of their money went to the Vatican than to themselves.
Right, right,
and drug money.
Yeah, and the question is, did this ever end? I mean, we're told that during the Cold War, this was done by the Vatican because they had a common interest with the CIA, which was to fight against communism. Communism threatening the interests of the Catholic Church, and likewise, of course, the U.S. was into this Cold War period, so they had that common interest, and that's why the Vatican was able to look the other way and launder this dirty drug money for the CIA and work with these Operation Gladio criminals.
But
the question then would be, well, the Cold War is over. Are they still doing it anyway?
Well, what happened is the Vatican funneled all these Nazi war criminals down to the Latin American dictatorship. And so they engaged in all the crimes you could think of, you know, especially being drug trafficking. And a lot of these Nazis who went to the Latin American countries and assisted the dictators in South America in eliminating people. And so as it turns out, the Bertolio, who became Francis I, and he was brought from Argentina, was very involved with assisting the dictatorship came in Argentina to get rid of these left-leaning priests and so on. So then he comes in. There were a lot of trials that started happening in Argentina and elsewhere of these corrupt clerics who were helping to eliminate people.
Right, and Pope Francis has a reputation as a very simple, peaceful, loving kind of pope. A lot of people are very excited about him, and then yet there's this kind of dark side to his past.
Well, what I figured out when I saw your thing that the Knights of Malta fire vengeance, of course that makes perfect sense if they wanted to get Bertolio in, because he could help assist with keeping all these things covered up in Latin America.
Right, right. And you know, there seemed to be two perspectives on this transition of popes that I was seeing. You know, one was that this, you know, this change of popes in the Vatican was actually a positive thing. It was an attempt to get past the corruption that had gotten completely out of control. And then the other perspective was that, no, this was actually a kind of a Vatican coup d'etat, and it was conducted by the very corrupt forces that we thought we were getting rid of. Danny Sheehan was on the show recently, and he has a very positive view of the current Pope Francis. He thinks that the Vatican's on the road to cleaning its own house. But I take it you're skeptical about that.
Well, I don't really have any strong opinions one way or another, but it has been pointed out that Pope Francis would be much more effective than Pope Benedict was in trying to cover up these scandals in Latin America. with priests being tried and sentenced to prison for all their, you know, for all these horrendous crimes during the dictatorships in Latin America that were, you know, created by dictators and these Nazi war criminals that the Vatican sent there to begin with.
And do you think that Francis was guilty of actively working with the dictatorship in Argentina to finger the left-wing priests to provide the names so those people could be rounded up and thrown out of airplanes and over the ocean?
I sent you a link on a video that addressed just this, and these people in Latin Argentina said yes, that he actively betrayed his own priests.
Right, and that's but there, you know, there are other scandals as well. There's the money laundering scandal that we were referring to. Of course, there were references in the press after the popes, the transition of popes, to so-called sexual Freemasonry, which involves apparently the kind of decadent and depraved sexual activities of these people who are involved in the money laundering scams, and that, according to some reports, Pope Benedict had gotten very depressed when, you know, he realized the extent of the control of the Vatican by these kinds of bad actors, and even his own secretary apparently betrayed him. So, you know, when Danny Sheehan tells me that the church is on the road to getting its house cleaned up, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. Danny thinks, though, he was saying, and he broke this news on my show, actually, if it happens, I got the scoop of the century. He said that Pope Francis will be resigning in a few years, and Martin O'Malley, the Bishop of Boston, will be the next pope. And Danny thinks that's great. He likes O'Malley. He says O'Malley is totally honest. You know, if you're not an insider, I guess you never really know the truth about these things.
Yeah. Well, the Catholic hierarchy has been so corrupted by, you know, people like the Rothschilds and the CIA, you know, as David Diatis pointed out, who becomes Knights of Malta, that we don't have any, we're not pinning any hopes on the Catholic Church becoming a force for good in the world.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a lot of bureaucracies, you know, maybe they start out with noble intentions, or, you know, their original purpose is to do something useful or provide a useful service or solve a problem. You know, the Catholic Church is, of course, there supposedly to cater to people's spiritual needs, and yet over time these bureaucracies take on their own kind of life as just a, you know, their whole point is self-perpetuation, and that leads to more and more corruption. And we, you know, you look back 1,000 years and the popes were even worse. You know, there was a long line of really insanely corrupt popes. This is an age-old problem. And you know, who knows, it may not go away anytime soon. But speaking, you mentioned the CIA and its Vatican drug money laundry. And in your work, you've also, you know, you've taken on the corruption of the FBI. And that leads to the question, you know, which of the two agencies is more corrupt, the CIA or the FBI? We have the FBI that actually exposed the CIA, whether fully advertently or not, with regard to the anthrax component of the 9/11 anthrax coup d'etat. It was the FBI that didn't allow the CIA and Battelle Memorial Labs to get away with trying to pin the anthrax attack on al-Qaeda terrorists working with Saddam Hussein, which was the original intention. But the anthrax turned out to be the wrong strain. It was the Ames strain, and that was only made in America. So the attempt to pin it on Iraq through al-Qaeda fell flat on its face, which was pretty embarrassing because they had set up the alleged hijackers with anthrax. So they had all of these tracks leading from anthrax to the 9/11 hijackers, and all of that had to be covered up and buried and forgotten about after the FBI showed that the Ames anthrax strain had to have come from an American lab, not an Iraqi lab. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that was an instance where the FBI, whether intentionally or not, exposed CIA malfeasance. But it seems like the FBI at its top levels is at least as corrupt as the CIA. That they
in the FBI and the CIA, you have two different channels of corruption. What happened after the Kennedy assassination is that H.L. Hunt and all these mafia people that he was associated with, like Carlos Marcello, were funneling mafia people into the FBI with J. Edgar Hoover. There was as William Pepper found out, that H.L. Hunt had a private dedicated telephone line from his office in Dallas to J. Edgar Hoover's office in Washington, D.C. So we had these church committee hearings on COINTELPRO, and it came out how the FBI was getting mafia people to just eliminate people that they didn't like.
And that was still happening recently. There was a guy at Boston who was involved in a huge number of hits, an FBI guy.
Yeah.
Doing mafia hits.
So the corruption of the FBI was created by H.L. Hunt with J. Edgar Hoover funneling mafia people into the FBI.
And, of course, Hoover famously said that there was no such thing as organized crime in America. Remember that?
Well, the big mobsters had him wrapped around their little fingers.
We've heard that they had dirty pictures of Hoover.
Oh, yeah, they were blackmailing him. And so he would do anything that the mafia people wanted. So, and H.L. Hunt and the Texas oil people were all tied with the mafia people. So there were a lot of mafia-eyed people that went into the FBI through that channel. So, and basically what I think COINTELPRO meant is FBI plus mafia. So that's the corruption of the FBI. And then on the CIA, you had Alan Dulles funneling in all these Nazi war criminals into the CIA. So, Nazi war criminals are basically the same as mafia people are. They're all gangsters.
Yeah, it kind of seems like this deep state elite from the very top of the financial world through all of these police and spy agencies are really top heavy with psychopathic gangster types. Is that what you need to rise to the top? You have to be a psychopath and a gangster?
Well, that's certainly what we have, thanks to J. Edgar Hoover and thanks to Alan Dulles. Pick your poison, whether you want the mafia with the FBI or whether you want the Nazi war criminals with the CIA.
Yeah, that's quite a choice there. yeah. It seems like they kind of got together on the JFK assassination, which was a real step towards this this closet dictatorship that we've got today. And so you think Alan Dulles was the prime architect of the JFK assassination, right?
Well, that's what appears to be the case. May Brussel did a lot of work in that connection, showing how all these Nazis, war criminals, we changed their names and so on, they all had connections with the Kennedy assassination. And the people, some of Lee Harvey Oswald's handlers were connected with these Nazi people and the CIA.
Right. Well, I mentioned the White Russian connection earlier with that painter who may have poisoned Franklin D. Roosevelt. And there was that White Russian connection in Dallas because Oswald's controller for the CIA was a fellow named George de Morenschel, who was a White Nazi. Russian with Nazi connections.
Yeah. And then another one, Page or something like that.
You're talking about Ruth Payne?
Yeah, Ruth Payne.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she was also a controller. She apparently was CIA. And who was it? I think it was it's funny this comes up because I'm staying in D.C. right now. I'm going to be at that Justice or Else event tomorrow on the National Mall. And I was here in D.C. several years ago to give a talk. and the people I stayed with actually knew Ruth Payne, as I recall, and knew that she was CIA. They'd run into her in Central America. I think it was Nicaragua, and she was down there posing as some kind of NGO person or something, and she was, like, clearly CIA. This would have been much later, like 70s, but they had her nailed as clearly CIA, doing CIA work in Nicaragua in, I think, the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And there she had been in Dallas in the thick of setting up Oswald as the patsy in the JFK hit.
Right.
But, you know, they don't even seem to really try to hide these things sometimes. Like, you know, to my mind, it wasn't just the assassination of President Kennedy that marked the end of real democracy in America, but it was the fact that they were able to have a known mafia hitman, Jack Rubenstein, walk through a sea of Dallas police officers with his gun drawn and have the police officers just kind of step back as Rubenstein just walks right up to the accused lone assassin of President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, and shoots him dead on live television. You know, if the American people accept that, they will accept anything. To me, that's it. When they had Jack Ruby murder Oswald on live television, it was like they were flipping the finger to the American people and saying, yeah, you can't stop us. Yeah, we can do anything. We can show it to you. We can shove it into your face, and you're powerless.
Well, I think I'm actually very hopeful about the emergence of all the assassination things right now. It's very clear from Pepper's work with the Martin Luther King assassination and with the RFK assassination that James Earl Ray and Sir Hunter were passing. There's just no doubt about it at all. And from all the work. Well, are you familiar with the Oswald Innocence campaign?
No. Tell me about that.
Well, I think they're gathering up the best experts on that, and they've had a big flurry of exposés about the alteration of photographs and all kinds of things showing how the assassination was clearly, set up and contrived to frame this patsy, Lee Harvey Oswald. And so it's now been pretty well proven that all these patsies were just that. And I think that, well, we've got the verdict, the Memphis verdict, that it was not James Earl Ray, but these other people who organized the MLK assassination. It's just plainly of evidence that Sirhan could not have shot Robert Kennedy because he was shot point blank from the rear into the base of his skull, whereas Sirhan was standing in front of him a few feet away. And he couldn't, no gun that Sirhan fired could have hit or did hit Kennedy. The real assassin fired point blank from the rear. So there's no doubt that Sirhan was a patsy, and he was, of course, in sort of a drug state, he was obviously, he'd gone through this MLK Ultra programming. He was programmed to just come out and fire some random shots, and Kennedy appeared, and then the real assassin shot Kennedy from the rear. So, and Pepper's representing him.
Yeah, now how is that going? You know, William Pepper actually won that case on behalf of the Martin Luther King family, proving that Dr. King was killed by this official conspiracy, this deep state conspiracy.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. He fortunately had a judge who granted this trial. It was his last trial as a judge. He's an elderly black judge, and his name is Swearingen. He was very straight shooter, and he allowed this trial and the verdict to proceed. But with Pepper dealing with the LA The California Attorney General and these the judges in the court there, if you read the proceedings, you see how totally corrupt they can make the judiciary. I mean, this last verdict in the first phase of things to give Sirhan a new trial was just a charade. And you read what the judge Wishrich was saying, and it's just complete nonsense.
Now when did that ruling come out?
Oh, it was
it was pretty recently, right?
Yeah, it's already been appealed now to the appeals court. But the same thing's going to happen again because no one hears any of these proceedings. And what happened in this first round with Judge Wishrich really needs to be publicized because it's a complete travesty that judges could write those sorts of things and rule the sorts of things that they have ruled. So it's gone to this appeals thing, and what will happen is it'll probably be the same thing will happen. Second rule of appeals to the Supreme Court, but we know from this thing, this article that Duff wrote that the CIA was, I mean, the Supreme Court was corrupted, criminalized in the Bush 2000 election. So the real point is that when you have a monetary system in which private bankers control the currency of the company, of the country, that They can pay off anyone any amount without any deduction. So that's what happened when we got the Federal Reserve passed in 1913, as we got our money being run by criminals in a private banking operation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, whoever prints the money is in a position to buy up as many people as they need, I guess.
Yeah, so the Federal Reserve can just, they can just print money and bribe anyone any amount they want. And there's no record of it. There's been no audit of the Federal Reserve in 100 years.
Well, I guess Rand Paul was trying to audit the Fed with mixed success.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I am hopeful for right now is the fact that all these assassinations are now becoming so clearly part of a pattern with these pasties and with all these proven innocent pasties with other proven people who actually did the crimes, that I think the lid can start coming off of all this pent-up mountain of corruption that is indicated with these assassinations.
Well, I spoke to Bill Pepper about his plans to try to do some 9/11 litigation. And what he said when I talked to him last a couple of years ago was that you need to very carefully select your judicial venue, because often if you can't get anywhere with a particular lawsuit, even if you're right, because it's a corrupt venue, it's often not worth even to bringing the lawsuit. And that's why I wonder, he was always very careful about which lawsuits that he would actually file. And I had thought that maybe he had shopped a little bit and scouted out things, and that he actually had hopes that he could get some justice for Sirhan, but it sounds like maybe not.
Well, the thing is that it is with Judge Wishrich and then the judge just about him in L.A. So farcically, but there's no doubt at all that Sirhan did not fire any shot that hit Kennedy. It's impossible, because he was standing in front of Kennedy, and the shot that killed Kennedy was fired in the back of his head, point blank range. So all the evidence was described as very narrow, and you would think that they would have no qualms. They wouldn't just make these fraudulent rulings. But when there's no public attention to what's going on, that's what's happened. So some attention really needs to be drawn to this whole series of things with Judge Wistrich in this last series in L.A., because that was just a part I was...
You know, I'll try to get William Pepper back on the show to talk about that, because we haven't really discussed the Sirhan Bobby Kennedy thing on this show. We've talked about 9/11, we've talked about Dr. King, but we haven't talked about that one. So that's something that we need to do here to publicize it.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, I'll send an email right away. I send an email all the time, and I've been urging him that that's what he really needs to do. Is we need to get some public hearing of what happened with this Judge Wistrich and ridiculous proceedings there.
Right. Well, every November there's a kind of a public relations battle between the cover-up side of the JFK assassination and those of us who are trying to push the truth. And so every year in November, I'll bring guests on my radio show like Judith Barry Baker, who is Oswald's girlfriend and knows he was innocent. I've had St. John Hunt. Actually, I'm going to have St. John Hunt on the show in this November. He's got a new book out. His father, Howard Hunt, the CIA assassin, confessed to him that he, Howard Hunt, was part of the B team, he said, in the CIA's assassination of President Kennedy. That's our deathbed confession. And, it's funny that the people who are still sticking to the Oswald acted alone line, which has been so disproven by now, they don't even, they used to say, well, where's the confession? Well, now we have a confession, but that's not enough. They keep raising the bar. If you don't want to believe something, I guess it doesn't matter how much proof is brought before you. You're just not going to accept it.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing encouraging, and that's that double the number of people believe that the CIA organized the Kennedy assassination and believe that the Harvey Oswald had anything to do with it.
That's right, yeah. And, ever since the early 90s when the movie JFK by Oliver Stone came out, a strong majority of Americans have pretty much gotten it right. But the problem is we don't have justice. And that brings me back to why I'm here in Washington, D.C. tonight, is the Justice or Else March that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is leading. And, he's gotten a huge backlash from the usual suspects who are accusing Minister Farrakhan of supposedly calling for the mass murder of white people. This is a complete, calumny. It's just slander that was made up and spread all over the internet, all over, certain kinds of media outlets. And you can tell that he's touched a nerve, because Minister Farrakhan is getting on in years. He talks pretty young, but he's getting on in years. And I think that, he kind of would like to see a little more movement for justice, at this point in his life. And so he's totally fearless, calling for justice on all of these kinds of issues, as well as the Black Lives Matter issue, which, of course, is so big these days. And I admire somebody like him. He's such an eloquent speaker and totally unafraid of calling it the way he sees it and standing up and demanding justice. And of course, for that reason, he's always going to be slandered and smeared in the mainstream media. But that should be a sign that he's doing something right. And more people are waking up and seeing this. They're noticing that if the mainstream media is really against somebody, then maybe that person actually has something going for them. And I think that's part of why Trump is doing so well. The media tried to hammer him and, keep finding ways to try to push him out of a race, and it just hasn't worked, because I don't think people really believe the media anymore.
All right. Well, I think, I think we're, with the work that the Oswald Innocence campaign is doing in showing how there's just, how Lee Harvey Oswald was just brain and all the things that they're turning up now, recently. And then now also with all this coming out about Alan Dulles and how, Alan Dulles and his brother were even in the 1930s, they were at the meetings in Nazi Germany, where they and the German bankers financed Hitler into power.
And here I just flew into Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., named after these Nazis.
Yeah.
I guess it's named after John Foster, not Allen, but
They were in it together. They were both Nazis. Real Nazis. They created the war and funded it through the war.
Right, and here's the biggest airport in D.C. named after him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I say the one thing that I see where some leverage can actually be begun is with showing how all these assassinations were done by the same modus operandi with these Patsies. All of them have that whole thing has come apart. The real people who were involved in the assassinations have been identified, convicted, and been the subject of rulings in court against them. And so that's where I think things can really happen. Because people can relate to individual things like assassinations and personal guilt with people, but it's very difficult for people to relate to things on such an enormous scale as 9/11.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are a lot of connections, though. You know, for one thing, the modus operandi that you're talking about is pretty similar for both assassinations and for false flag terror attacks, because in both cases, typically, they'll set up a patsy who couldn't possibly have done all the damage that's been done, but they've discovered that they don't have to put up a real plausible patsy because people will accept it, the judiciary will accept it. Just put up somebody, and you send a truck bomb into Oklahoma City, and it couldn't possibly take out as much of that building as was taken out. But who cares? You got your patsy, Timothy McVeigh. With 9/11, you claim that it was done by hijacked airplanes, and of course, those hijackers would never have been able to take over even one of those planes, much less all four, much less be able to fly them accurately, much less at those speeds of, faster than they could possibly fly near sea level, much less hit their targets perfectly, much less have the buildings magically disappear at free fall acceleration through the path of most resistance. But it doesn't matter, because you've just held up a patsy and waved it around. And, three buildings blowing up, supposedly all from, 19 guys with box cutters. It's the same kind of thing, like Sirhan couldn't possibly have fired that point blank shot to the back of Bobby's head, but it doesn't matter. You've just thrown your patsy out there and somehow people accept this.
Well, the thing is when some judge will accept it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's the institutions get corrupted. The media, the judiciary.
The key to all this corruption is that all these criminals have Rockefeller counterfeits to bribe anyone that they want. Federal Reserve notes, phony money that they just can print out of thin air in any amount without any trace. And so the Federal Reserve is the perfect crime syndicate. They can just bribe anyone any amount, and it makes no difference. And there's no trace.
Well, you mentioned that it's easier to wake people up on assassinations than on something as big as 9/11. But, how about the issue of the Federal Reserve and trying to get back to an honest currency system? That's something that a lot of people who are afraid of these scary issues like false flag terror and assassinations can deal with. Ellen Brown, who's a currency reform person, she gets a very warm reception in all sorts of, friendly, nice, foundation-funded liberal groups, the kind of people that would never invite me to speak, but they'll invite her to speak because that issue is a lot more user-friendly, and that issue cuts right to the heart of the power of this criminal cabal. Do you have hope that we're going to be able to take down the Federal Reserve and the Bankster Crime Syndicate?
I think the way to do it is through a constitutional convention.
Really? Now, specifically geared towards the currency issue?
Yeah, a constitutional convention, and in the new constitution, there's no Federal Reserve Bank.
Well, wait a minute. The constitution we have doesn't have any provisions for a Federal Reserve Bank.
I think it would be easier to have all this done under a constitutional convention with a completely reformed federal government.
Well, see, I would be a little bit afraid that if we had a constitutional convention, the corrupt powers that be might try to scrap the Bill of Rights. They've already shredded it and it exists right now in name only, but, you know, they might just, like, formally put an end to it. So couldn't we just have maybe an amendment, like a constitutional amendment, forcing the Treasury to print real currency backed by something and putting the Fed out of business?
Apparently there's a provision that the government can buy out the contractors and the Federal Reserve for $2 billion. But the thing is, and the reason I became so keen on the Jane Stafford timeline from 1905 to 1913 is to show that the Federal Reserve Bank was established, the act was passed, based on the murder of Jane Stafford and the bribery of Theodore Roosevelt. He got $100 million to fill the election to Woodrow Wilson. And then the person they got to use the probate fraud, Jane Stafford, Whitelaw Reid, ends up getting appointed ambassador to the UK. So he could go and liaise with the Rothschilds in 1905 to create the Federal Reserve Act. And then when they had finished doing that in 1912, then they tossed it to Theodore Roosevelt to enter the race and throw the election to Woodrow Wilson so he'll sign it. So we really got them on it. We can really show that the Federal Reserve was specifically based on murder and fraud and election rigging.
Right.
So that's one thing that can come out of my book on is based on my 300 emails with Dr. Cutler. And then the other thing that we can show at them is that in 1993 in Utah, in this receivership fraud, that's got to drive huge case of court corruption. I can show how criminalized FBI agents engineered this fraudulent receivership. And so that can... And then what happened to the Rico Hoover files for finding all these gold deposits? So we've got some real things that we can tackle them with in Utah. And the last thing is that I've just succeeded over the last year in identifying what will be, with quite some certainty, one of the great gold deposits to emerge now. In Nevada, and you can't cover up a multi-billion-dollar gold deposit, and that gives you a lot of firepower, and that's what we've got now.
And it's possible that this house of cards could collapse as the economy goes belly up, as the petrodollar loses its status as global reserve currency. You think that maybe an economic crisis could lead to the conditions that would make change possible?
Well, yeah, certainly that's one of the few possibilities.
Yeah, and I see that coming. You know, when I look at some other situations, like Argentina had a very brutal dictatorship. We were talking about how Pope Francis, back when he was a bishop in Argentina, was complicit in this dictatorship's murder of the activist priests and nuns. They would come and grab people and put them in airplanes and go fly over the ocean, throw them out of the airplane over the ocean.
Yeah.
And they murdered large numbers of people that way. They tortured people. But the only way that the Argentine people got rid of those fascist military dictators was by reaching the point where their economy had collapsed and they'd lost a war. They lost the Falklands War, discredited themselves, and then the economy collapsed. And suddenly it was possible to overthrow those guys. And I see something developing similarly here, where we've lost these 9/11 wars. We got our butts kicked by a bunch of ragtag jihadis in Afghanistan, by a bunch of amateurs in Iraq, and we're losing in Syria. It looks like the losing the war part has happened in spades, and the economy is kind of just chugging along on life support. And when it totally tanks, at that point, I think that maybe we might be in a position to deal with our fascist junta the way the Argentines did.
Hmm.
So that's what I hope, anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to see a financial collapse that could cause a lot of human suffering, but I also would hate to see these criminal oligarchs continue in power indefinitely.
People are waking up all over the place, I think. You know, Eustace Mullins was very hopeful about that people were waking up to the Federal Reserve. Did a lot of very great things. And May Brussels in her life was so explicit in exposing the Nazis in the CIA and elsewhere. It's saying the truth is all there, and something it's not going to take much very soon to make it all come together and people to realize what's what.
Right. Yeah. There have been some good works on the New World Order banksters recently. James Perloff has a classic bestseller on the topic. And then there's Mujahid Kamran over in Pakistan, a physics professor who's written some fantastic stuff, including 9/11 and the New World Order. And then his new book is called International Banksters, World War I, World War II, World War III and Beyond or something. Lots of really good stuff being produced. More and more people are waking up. People know what the expression New World Order means now. When George H.W. Bush used that expression after the Gulf War on September 11th, 1991, I believe it was, when he introduced that, most people didn't know what he was talking about. But today, more and more people do. And I don't know, do you think it's a race between people waking up and the powers that be, coming up with new techniques to put them back to sleep?
Well, I think they're running out of, their criminal mechanisms. That's what Eustace Mullins thought.
Yeah, and that might explain why they've resorted to such desperate measures. 9/11 was really a new kind of thing. Nobody had ever given half of the American population clinical post-traumatic stress disorder before, just from TV images. That was a whole new thing. And that's such an over-the-top thing. It really suggests to me that that's the act of people who are feeling desperate. And since then, we've seen more signs of desperation. And today, the political system seems so broken. Both parties are yammering pitifully about how we need to stand up to Putin and so on, but that kind of bravado and bluster that we're hearing, especially from Republicans, seems to me like it's they're protesting too much. I mean, I think people know that this whole system is kind of on its last legs.
Yeah. Well, it's been thoroughly corrupted. The started when they passed the Federal Reserve Act and put the country's money in the hands of private criminal bankers.
Right, that was a coup d'état that kind of kept on giving.
All that started with poisoning James Stafford and the Federal Reserve, and then when they made all the Nazi stuff happen, and then they spread all the Nazis all over Latin America and into the CIA and elsewhere. And so the big picture is becoming abundantly clear. But what makes me hopeful is just that I found a tremendous gold deposit out in Nevada, and that's going to provide a lot of resources to do a lot of new things.
All right. Well, is there any way listeners can help you?
You mean the show here?
Yeah, or maybe you can help them.
they can keep track of things on the whole exposure side by looking at the website www.greatgoldgrab.com, And I'll, I haven't put anything up on there yet about all this new gold discovery, but I probably will. And there is this really good network that developed with the Oswald Innocent campaign. And I'll have to put you in touch with the fellow who's organized that, Ralph Sink, because they've really gotten a lot of things to the surface now, and there's real...
I'll try and bring him on for an interview. We're coming into JFK assassination season, so it's time to bring him on and tell people about the Oswald Innocence campaign. And I'll be doing other interviews around the JFK assassination as well with people like St. John Hunt. Well, hey, appreciate the great inspiration you're spreading around, Stephen Requa. I appreciate your great work here, and people can go to the Great Gold Grab and find out more about it. So, hey, thanks again, and keep up the great work.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Kevin Barrett, Truth Jihad Radio. TruthJihad.com is the website.